south or west of the Rock Isles. Farther west and north than where they now sailed, Lace's map marked the perpetual storm, where the skies were known to be violent and dangerous. But they'd never come this far to know for sure. Caledonia had a dim memory of sailing waters in search of a way out of the bullet seas. The waves rushed from all sides, the seas biting at the hull. The sky grew suddenly dark, as though the sun had set in the middle of the day. Pisces' mother had gathered the children and rushed them below decks, where they strapped in to keep from being heaved from one side of the room to the other. It had seemed to last for days, which couldn't be true. However long it was, Rona had reversed course and taken them safely south again, to the Bone Mouth. They had never returned. Any notes or maps Rona might have kept about the event had been destroyed in the attack, and there had never been a need to travel farther than the Rock Isles. Until now. Hesperus's map centered on the canals, but the waters around it were charted for at least 100 miles. Even if there was a chance it couldn't be trusted, it contained more information in more detail than anything else in their collection. The girls studied it in silence. Amina marked where they were with a small black stone. The waters east of their location would be dense with bullets, while directly west, the tall grasses stretched toward the perpetual storm. Directly north were the Rock Isles they'd just left, and south was the wrong direction entirely. If it were possible to sail a straight line through the Rock Isles, they'd reach the North Water in only a week's time. As it was, two options lay before them. They could cut due west, pushing through the grass flats and risking their propulsion system in the process. Or they could return north, risking another encounter with the gulls, and from there, skirt the western edge of the Rock Isles. "According to the bullet, according to Orin," Pisces cut in, "his name is Orin." She lifted her chin, daring Caledonia to argue. "We have 2 weeks to reach the North Water and intercept Electra to save our brothers. We know there's a small fleet after us in the east, which leaves west and north. So," Caledonia looked up, ready for suggestions. "Gulls or grass? No good options," Red Tooth remarked with irritation. "It'd be nice to have some good options for a change." "I'm inclined to take the grass over gulls," Caledonia admitted. "We've been running hard, and grass will slow us down, but we're unlikely to encounter any more bullets that way. And we know how to manage grass." Hime held her nose close to the map, her finger tracing a section of land that skirted the southern bend of the tall grasses, as if looking for a hint of deceit from the mapmaker. Pisces leaned in. "I think we should return north. We can run slow and quiet and cut west as soon as possible." Caledonia studied her friend, unable to determine if this was a real suggestion or another attempt to argue. "If we end up in another fight, we could deplete our ammunition," she countered, "and we don't have much to spare." "Those gulls will think twice before coming after us again." Pisces' tone was uncharacteristically cool. "And grass is risky." "We've sailed through grass before," Pisces nodded. "But we don't know how far the flats go. We've never sailed these waters, and the gulls were herding us in that direction for a reason." "The map shows that they thin here." Caledonia took a steadying breath and pressed a finger to a spot on the map where the hash marks were obviously farther apart. "You really want to trust Hesperus, the man who tried to turn us over for the bounty? How is that any better than trusting a bullet who saved my life?" Pisces argued. "I'll trust a crooked merchant over a dirty bullet in a heartbeat," Caledonia fired back. Pisces' eyes widened. She was losing patience just as quickly as Caledonia. "Based on everything we know, the fastest, most reliable way to the northern currents is to move north and cut west as soon as possible." It might be fast, but it could be a minefield. We don't know how many crews like the gulls hang close to the rock isles, and I don't want to find out. We've been fighting for days. The crew needs a break.
What about food? Pisces pressed.
Far says we have 5 days, but we all know what that means. It'll be 5 days until all we've got left is water. If we go north toward the rock isles, we can at least send the bow boats to forage on the coast. There's no promise of food if we go west.
There's never a promise of food, Pie.
This wasn't the familiar terrain of their disagreements. The place where Pisces challenged Caledonia to ensure her plans were sound. Instead, there was fear and frustration between them. They both wanted the same thing, to save their brothers. They were about as far from that goal as they could possibly be. They had no notion of how they would board the Electra when they found her, and the wrong choice now might mean losing Donnelly and Ares forever. Hime straightened and raised her hands decisively. She pointed, drawing all their attention to the same spot on the map she'd been inspecting.
These are the Drowning Lands. Dangerous sailing, but many settlements where we can trade for food.
Are you sure? Amina asked. The grasses are still an issue.
The captain is right. They're thinner here. Passable if we do it right. They'd all heard of the Drowning Lands, a long stretch of marshy lands tucked away in the south. They were rumored to be inhabited, but the people were all but ghosts. Ships that entered the Drowning Lands were never seen again. The location was only speculation. But Hime seemed certain.
How do you know? Caledonia asked.
Hime faltered, her hands fluttering momentarily.
I've been here before. Long ago.
Long ago? Caledonia rounded on the gentle girl, frustration brimming over. You knew exactly what those gulls were up to. Now you say you know the location of the Drowning Lands, and I'd like to know how.
Before Hime could answer, Amina's voice crashed down like a yardarm.
Captain, she warned. She just told you she's been here before.
Caledonia held her ground.
She also told me she'd stay below decks, but that didn't stop her from taking up arms today.
I told you, I can fight. I want to fight. Hime's cheeks flushed as she spoke, her hands moving decisively.
You protect me too much.
You have always needed our protection,
Caledonia nearly shouted.
But I never asked for it.
Amina turned fully to the captain, eyes dangerous.
If she says she's ready to fight, I believe her. You should too. She broke the rules, and this entire crew saw her do it. Caledonia!
Pisces shouted. The breath caught in Caledonia's throat. Her small world was spinning too fast.
You need to remember that we are not your enemy. We are your crew. We're loyal, and we will serve you until the end. But that doesn't mean we'll be blindly obedient.
Pisces' hand clenched into a fist.
I'm not asking you to be obedient. I'm only asking that you follow the rules, to follow me.
Hime and Amina glanced at each other. Red Tooth took a step back.
The rules don't keep us safe, Caledonia. We keep one another safe. If you'd trust us to do that, we wouldn't need rules at all.
Heat tightened around Caledonia's neck. Pisces had never challenged her so directly in front of the command crew. And never would have if not for that damn bullet in their hold. Her small rebellion had turned into something so much more, encouraging Amina and even Hime to act against her orders. It was like sand shifting beneath her feet.
We need to pick a route.
She pressed her eyes shut for a moment, then resettled them on the map. Grass was trouble, but less trouble than another gunfight. And the possibility of trade for food was stronger than a chance to forage.
We go west, Caledonia gave the order with as much conviction as she could muster.
Pisces gave her a hard look. The wall between them grew thicker in that instant. Then she turned, and without another word, left the room. Chapter 23. Caledonia stood alone on the wing of the bridge as the Moors Navis approached the tall grass flats. They'd decided to wait until morning to navigate the grassy seas, as it had been a long night for the captain. She tossed in her bunk, hot, even though a fresh breeze moved through the cabin. She played through her argument with Amina, but her mind stagnated on the memory of Pisces and her accusations. She couldn't shake them, and couldn't pinpoint the place where she'd gone wrong. When she eventually slept, her dreams were haunted by a girl whose face flashed between laces, wind-chapped cheeks, and nettles curling scars. She dreamed of drowning in seas thickly corded with grass and kelp, surrounded by one of Donnelly's sweet songs. By the time the sun spilled over the horizon, she'd been covered in a thin film of sweat, and her hair was a nest around her neck. She'd washed and wrestled her wet hair into a braid so tight it hurt. The crew was quiet this morning. They moved through their duties without the usual banter that accompanied the rising sun. They may not have been in the room yesterday, but they knew their command crew was uneasy, and it cast a pall over the entire ship. The Moors Navis was anchored in place and floated without propulsion or thrusters, giving Caledonia time to study the way ahead. While the map gave her a good sense of where to go, finding the specific path was up to her. The longer she looked over the water, the more determined she was to prove she could take them through it. Rona would have done it without a second thought. There were no swirls or eddies to suggest large rocks, but there were variations in the surface that spoke to what lay beneath. Most of the water was covered in little ripples, sharp and small with no sense of depth. This was where the grasses were the thickest and most likely to gum up their systems. At a glance, it encompassed the water for miles around, but Caledonia had been watching, letting the water reveal itself, and she'd found a path where the water rose and fell in small waves. That was where the grass was thin, and that was where the Moors Navis would pass. Something brushed lightly against her arm, and she turned to find lovely Hime standing with her on the wing. Her braid was tied with one of her bright blue ribbons and pulled forward again, hiding the scars once more. The morning light splashed against the glossy black strands and shone through her wide oval eyes. She was like a beautifully banded agate, thin layers pressed together in a crescendo of color, but only ever knowable from one inadequate angle. When they'd brought her aboard, before any of them had learned to speak her language, and before she was capable of communicating at all, they'd been struck by the loveliness of her. Even sweating through her withdrawal, raging against demons no one could see except for her, she was lovely. And that was what they'd called her. Little Lovely. It was only a few weeks before they learned her loveliness ran as deep as the ocean. By that time, the name was a part of the crew. The only difference was that they'd learned her real name, too. "Good morning," Caledonia said, with her voice and her hands. Hime smiled, licked her lips, and raised her hands. "I'm sorry." Two words, and Caledonia was cast into the press of emotions she'd worked all night to lock away. A captain needed to care, but even more than that, she needed to keep her mind free of caring too much. Hime had a right to fight, and Caledonia had a right to stop her. "I understand that you want to fight, but that didn't go well for Red the first time, and we need you safe, Hime." Caledonia's sign was slower than her words, but when it was just the two of them, she didn't mind. "You are the best healing hand we have. We need you when the fighting is over." "I'm not as fragile as you think." Hime pressed her lips tight together. Her fingers clenched, and she took a moment to ready herself before she spoke again. Do you ever think about going somewhere else? The sudden change of topic stunned Caledonia enough that she said the first thing that came to her mind. You mean beyond the net? No. Every girl on this ship had thought about it from time to time. Caledonia would be lying if she said she never had. But the terrible truth was that nothing brought her peace like the thought of driving Eric's fleet beneath the waves. Like the thought of driving her dagger into Lear's heart. And now, like the thought of bringing her brother home to fight at her side. Himei's expression tightened. Her eyes traveled over the water. And Caledonia had the very clear sense that she'd misunderstood the girl. Himei raised her hands. Pisces is right. These grasses are trouble. It's very rare that anyone gets through them. There were many things from Himei's time among Eric's fleet that Caledonia had chosen not to ask about. No one on this ship needed any more information than Himei was willing to share. As a scythe, she'd been kept on the barges, her task to tend to the bale blossoms from seedling to harvest and transform them into silt. It was also her job to test every batch. Her addiction was no small beast. If Himei knew something of these waters from her time as a scythe, it was worth listening to, though she'd been so thoroughly drugged that it was hard to know if the information was entirely trustworthy. Did you sail these waters on your barge? Himei looked out over the rippling waters, her gaze traveling farther than she could possibly see. She raised her hands. Yes, once. We didn't make it. Barges were much larger than the Moor's Navis, their hulls just as shallow, but they used propellers rather than propulsion that relied on pulling water through the ship at high speeds. It was enough of a difference for Caledonia. We will, she said, eyes still cast ahead. Is there anything else I need to know? Himei paused, nodded. You read the water like it's a book. If anyone can get through, it's you. Caledonia smiled and called to her deck crew. Weigh anchor! Overhead, the air was peppered with seabirds scooping low over the grass-infested waters to catch fish trapped near the surface. To the north, the rock isles had been swallowed by the horizon. The air was warm, the sun climbing, and Caledonia listened to the rhythmic clink of the rising anchor with a sense of confidence in the task ahead. She would take them through these waters, and they'd be that much closer to finding their brothers. When she returned to the bridge, Tin was at the helm, her bridge crew secure in their stations, and there was Pisces coming off the companionway ladder and heading toward her. Caledonia braced for another argument. Ready when you are, Captain. Pisces gave a nod. All traces of their previous argument were gone. Tucked away and stored while they stood in front of the eyes of the crew. I have 15 girls down in propulsion. We're with you. A smile threatened, but Caledonia fought through it. Engines on full. We're going to gain as much momentum as possible, then kill the engines and coast. Tin, nose 2 degrees starboard. We're aiming for the water with the most chop. The Moor's Navis climbed quickly to speed, driving faster and faster until they were nearly upon the tall grass flats. Caledonia moved out onto the command deck where her view of the water was clear, waiting as long as possible before giving the order to cut the engines. They powered down, and the ship slid neatly into the slim bend of water that looked like a path. Suddenly, a hissing noise filled the air. On either side of the ship, long grasses brushed the hull, bending over to drape themselves along the length of the ship. There was no space between the blades. They obscured the water completely. It was as if the sea had transformed into a silky green fabric that now embraced the ship. The loss of inertia was so immediate that the force of it tugged at Caledonia's body. On open seas with the current at their back, The momentum they'd gathered would have kept them going for a mile. But here, the grasses kissed their speed away, dragging them down like the mermaids of legend. Caledonia kept her eyes on the barely there slice of water before them and saw that it narrowed. "Engines to minimum," she said. And when they'd used up the available space, she gave the order to drift again. They continued in this way for several hours, moving in and out of speed whenever the grass thinned enough to warrant it. Pisces sent runners back and forth to the bridge with updates. Her team was working as fast as they could to clear the grass now threading their system. They climbed into the narrow outtake valves and hacked at the fibrous stalks, which they could only do safely when the engines were down. It took time, but they were finding their rhythm, moving forward little by little. It was slow, steady progress, and Caledonia was starting to breathe a little easier. Until the path ahead disappeared entirely. Before them, the grasses braided together in thick cords, lying on top of the ocean as though there were nothing beneath it. Caledonia searched for a way through the green. The path she'd chosen had taken them farther south than she'd hoped to go. So far that she could see the beginnings of a swampy shore reaching toward them. They were surely the first ruffling skirts of the drowning lands. There was no path to shore, and the surface of the water was flat as glass, as far ahead as the eye could see. "Captain," a runner appeared in the doorway. "Pisces says we need to power down." She shook her head. "We can't. Tell her to keep the girls out of the valves until I give the word." The girl hesitated, then ran off to carry the message below decks. The only chance they had was to power up and hope their momentum carried them across the slick grass. "Engines to full. We need all the speed we can get." Her crew complied. The ship rumbled, and with less agility than usual began to pick up speed. Grasses hissed against the metal hull, dragging and slapping it in displeasure, when suddenly the ship bucked and the rumble of the engine vanished. Caledonia cursed. The ship drifted, slowing until they stopped altogether. If they tried to spin the engines up again, they'd pull even more of the thick grass into the propulsion system. They could send up the masts, rig the sails, but the breeze that rippled over the water wasn't the sort that would budge the ship. They were stuck. And until they could clear the engines, or a firm wind drove in, they'd stay that way. Caledonia cursed again. Even now, the Electra was probably preparing for her journey along the Northwater conscription routes. Every single moment was precious. She drew a deep breath. Blood, gunpowder, salt. They could work through this. They just needed to be patient. Before she could convene her command crew, a cry. "Ships! Port bow!" There, six vessels raced across the grass-infested waters in boats that seemed to barely touch the surface. The crafts were flat, with large fans whirring behind a steering console, and on each stood several figures. They poured out from between long reeds and scrub plants, clinging to the swampy shore. Behind them, five more vessels appeared, and behind those were another seven. 18 vessels in all. Immediately her crew reached for their weapons, training sights on the approaching vessels, steely and ready to fight. The air hummed as the small fleet approached the Moor's Navis. Each vessel held at least four figures, some more, but none less. They outnumbered Caledonia's crew nearly 2-1. They were armed, and not lightly. One vessel pulled away from the group, aiming for the bow with guns up. A shower of gunfire scattered across the nose of the Moor's Navis. None hit the ship, but the point was made. They had firepower, numbers, and mobility. Without propulsion, Caledonia only had firepower.
"Hands up, girls," Caledonia called, with bitterness in her voice.
"Captain," Redtooth came to her side, a fight bristling in her voice. "We still have the advantage of height. We can at least thin the herd."
"They're not bullets. And those were warning shots. We may be able to talk our way out of this."
As they watched, the swarm of boats multiplied yet again, even more sliding away from shore. They circled, guns pointed at the deck, but not a single shot fired. The soldiers, men and women, trained their guns expertly and wore plates of blackened metal not unlike the armor of the gulls. It was the presence of the women that gave Caledonia hope. Women standing shoulder to shoulder with men. They might survive this yet.
"Surrender with peace, and we will do no harm!"
It was a woman's voice, strong, firm, demanding.
"I am Caledonia Styx, and this is my crew. We will do no harm and surrender."
In response, two hooks appeared over the rail, trailing a rope ladder. It pulled taut under the weight of someone beginning to climb. Panic was ready to bloom in Caledonia's chest. Redtooth was the first to greet the newcomer as she topped the rail. She stood too close, forcing the woman to carefully straddle the railing unless she wanted to collide with Redtooth's chest. The woman ducked her head, hiding a smile as she gripped the rail with strong hands and swung one leg over without hitting Redtooth. She was the soft taupe of an oak tree, with arms corded like thick ropes. Her armor was plated across her chest and banded around her shoulders, each piece curved to meet her body. Her hair was pulled back from the temples in twists, clasped with metal beads in steely gray and black, and the pearlescent color of an oyster shell. The woman met Redtooth eye to eye, and now that she stood on the deck, she crossed into Redtooth's face and didn't back down.
"Push back, girl," the woman said,
her voice dipping to show Redtooth exactly what she thought of her youth.
"Red?" Caledonia warned, though she would have liked to see Redtooth knock the woman back a few paces. She stepped between Redtooth and the woman.
"We can offer you coin in exchange for aid."
She spoke as though negotiation were expected, as though these people didn't have the obvious advantage. The woman's smile withered, all humor draining away.
"You know that's not how this will go, Caledonia Styx. This is the Drowning Lands, and you and your crew will disembark peacefully. Or, what has given you the impression that you have an alternative choice?"
"Captain," Amina's urgent whisper was in her ear.
"Tugs and welders."
On the water, the mudrunner boats were making room for the tugs. The crews tucked in close around the base of the hull, attaching lines fore and aft. And before another word was spoken between Caledonia and the woman, sparks flew as the welders got to work. They were taking the Moor's Navis apart.
Chapter 24. Caledonia had lost this ship once. Every single decision she'd made in the 4 years since had been designed to keep it running. She'd imagined if she ever lost it again, it would be the same day she lost her life. She'd imagined it would be bloody, the Moor's Navis in flames and her crew lost. Nothing like the unsettling peace of this moment. "This ship is worth far more than its metal," Caledonia could barely think past the hiss of fire against her hull. But the woman was unmoved.
"Not to a slagger. You can make your case to the Queen."
A twist of dread and fury tangled in Caledonia's throat. She was helpless. The ship was braided into the ocean, immobile and useless, and the entire crew had lowered their weapons.
The only option before them was surrender.
We'll go peacefully. Caledonia's lips felt numb as she spoke.
The woman before her shouted an order, and dozens of grip hooks appeared over the railing in response. From each dangled a rope ladder like the one she'd used.
I'm Sipa, she gestured to her own ladder.
After you, Captain.
It was all Caledonia could do to put one foot in front of the other and descend the ladder. On deck, her crew was thoroughly subdued, their expressions just as stunned as she felt. As her hand left the cool metal of her hull, she tried not to think that it was for the last time. Distantly, she registered how quickly her crew was funneled down the rope ladders and loaded onto mud runners. She spotted Amina and Hime nestled together. Nettle's multicolored ribbons caught her eye. Red Tooth growled as she was directed to a boat apart from Caledonia. But she caught no sign of Pisces. There was always a chance that Pisces had heard the commotion and hurried her team into the valves to avoid detection. Or perhaps she'd taken the blue lung and her toe and submerged. Whatever the reason, Caledonia hoped that her friend hadn't been harmed. Sipa climbed into the mud runner with Caledonia, and with a nod of her head, the soldier at the tiller revved the engine. A humid wind embraced them as they rushed away from the ocean. It carried with it a smell of rotting wood and sun-baked mud. Water gave way to muddy terrain, which gave way again to water so rapidly Caledonia couldn't track it. The boats traveled seamlessly from one to the other, startling long-legged birds and round frogs. After several miles, the first real trees appeared. They were scraggly, with knobby spines protruding from the water around them. Puffs of evergreen needles dripped from thin branches, allowing room for the sun to spill between them. They were not the glossy-leaved trees that sheltered the islands of the Bone Mouth, and Caledonia doubted they carried any fruit on their pale branches. She was peering between the jagged-looking trunks when she saw a building. It was a squat wooden shack elevated above the water on stilts, with a canoe tethered beneath. Once she'd spotted it, she noticed several others like it. There were dozens of the little houses, each raised on stilts and squatting high over the water. In the doorway of one stood a small child wearing a green smock that hung heavy to her knees, watching them pass as though the sight before her were a common occurrence. She raised her hand to wave, oblivious of the distress that brought them here. Soon they arrived at a building much larger than any of the others. It was round and capped by a sloping roof trimmed in solar lanterns and surrounded by a wide, wrapping porch. From the front, a staircase led directly down to the water, and on one side, a ramp arched like a bow. Caledonia's craft was the first to skid up the ramp, the vessel traveling less seamlessly over the rough tracks than it had over the swamplands. At the top, they were met by four guards. While one relieved Caledonia of her gun, another bound her hands. She didn't struggle. If their captors wanted them dead, they could have killed them back at the ship. And if they were meant to be prisoners, they'd have taken her blades in addition to her gun. They'd brought Caledonia and her crew into their home, which meant they wanted something from them. She just wasn't sure what. Caledonia was paraded down the porch to the front of the building, where she was visible to the rest of her approaching crew. The message was clear. Should anyone struggle, their captain would be the first to pay the price. One by one, her crew was unloaded and bound. Caledonia tried to count, but once her captors were satisfied that all her crew had seen her, they directed her through the front doors of the building and into a wide hall with vaulted ceilings. Though the walls were constructed of thick wooden planks, each contained a vein of polished metal snaking through the beams like little rivers. It made the room wink and glimmer, like it was surrounded by stars.
At the far end stood a throne. Like the walls, its thin wooden reeds were braided through with bands of silver. With feet that curved away from the base like the roots of a great tree. Upon it sat a woman. Her hands rested on either arm, and her chin was raised just enough to be intimidating. Long robes of purple and gray pooled around her feet, and her wrists were banded in the same polished silver that decorated the room. She was surrounded by men and women on all sides, their attention turned toward the girls now being driven across the room. When they were still some distance from the throne, Sipa pulled Caledonia to a halt, stepping in front of her and kneeling. "My queen, we bring you a crew of 54. They have sacrificed their ship in the grass flats and surrendered without a struggle. None were injured. We lost nothing in the taking." The queen turned her head to survey her catch, solar lights reflecting off the elaborate earrings that dripped along the full length of her ears. Her curly black hair was braided away from her temples in a manner similar to Sipa's, except the queen's hair was twisted around cords of metal. It gave the impression of a crown. "The water provides," the queen said at last. "The room repeats the phrase," and Sipa rose to her feet. The queen stood. Her skin was a pale satin brown, her eyes a cool gray. And though she wasn't tall, her presence was towering. Everyone in the room arranged themselves so that they stood apart from her, as though her regality created a palpable perimeter around her. "My queen," Sipa said, "this is Caledonia Styx. She leads this crew." The queen took a few steps forward, her gaze steady on Caledonia. It was a little like being approached by a towering wave, ready to submerge you. "Caledonia Styx." It was more a statement than a greeting. The queen moved on, passing down the line of girls. "You are in the Drowning Lands. Your ship is no longer your own. But your lives remain yours to direct." She continued to walk down the line as she spoke, casting her calm gaze from girl to girl. Some of them met her eyes. Others looked away. She didn't seem to prefer one response over the other, but, like a wave, moved on at a steady pace. "You are not our prisoners. The water has brought you to us, and you will always have a place among the slaggers. But you are also free to go." "In what ship?" Caledonia's voice sounded harsh after the smooth tenor of the queen. The queen didn't bother to turn around when she answered. "No ship. If you choose to leave, you leave by your own means." "On foot? Through the Drowning Lands?" Caledonia tried to keep her fury contained. "That's a dying choice." The queen turned this time, not to face Caledonia, but to move to the center of the room. "It is a challenging choice, just as this is a challenging world." Now Caledonia understood how they had maintained secrecy for so long. Once a ship had been taken in by slaggers, its crew became slaggers, and the room was filled with evidence of their undertakings. The fabrics of their clothing were tightly woven and missing the rips, patches, and odd seams that prevailed among her crew. Even the walls were ornamented with items that surely didn't come from these swampy lands. Long tapestries and segmented maps, and even paintings and photographs of the old worlds. These people weren't warriors or merchants. They were collectors, scavengers. "You've captured more than just my ship and my crew." Caledonia stepped forward, setting herself apart from her crew as the queen had done from her own people. "Eric Ahare has put a bounty on our heads. There's an entire fleet of bullet ships after us. If you hold us here, you're making yourselves a target." At the mention of the bullet fleet, a ripple passed through the men and women still standing to either side of the throne. The queen, however, gave no reaction.
"Then we are doing you a great favor," she said.
For the first time, her lips broke the plane of her face and edged a smile toward her gray eyes.
"There will soon be no ship left for them to track, and once you have chosen your place among my people, we will protect you from any threat."
She stepped back.
"Now, we must have decisions from each of you.
Who will say first, stay or go?"
Panic was a shock in Caledonia's lungs. She needed her ship. She needed her crew. Donnelly's life depended on it. Aerie's life depended on it. Staying here was not an option, but neither was wading through the drowning lands with no boat, no guns, nothing but the clothing on their backs. Why would her crew choose to follow her when all she had to offer them was a potentially fatal slog through the swamp? Suddenly, Hime broke away from the crew, racing toward the throne. Amina was there in an instant.
"Hime!"
she called, but Hime didn't stop. The room was in motion. Sipa's grip came down hard on Caledonia's shoulder. Four guards converged on the queen, while two more made for Hime, and Red Tooth darted after Amina. Hime was lifted from her feet and hauled back toward the center of the room. She didn't struggle, but she raised her hands, signing a single word. "Mother."
"Hime?"
A woman in a soft brown blouse and black pants stepped forward. She was short and slender in the way of willow reeds, with strength evident in the curve of her arms and legs. Her hair, tied in a long braid, was a glossy black, threaded with copious strands of gray.
"Hime, is that really you?"
The guard holding Hime in his grasp placed her gently on the ground as the woman moved forward. The closer she came, the more Caledonia saw it. The skin as pale as sparrow feathers, the eyes dark and ringed with gray and brown, the uncompromising beauty in the slope of her mouth. In the next moment, the woman confirmed it. She took Hime's hands in her own and, speaking softly through the fall of her tears, said,
"My daughter, you've come home."
Chapter 25. There was a tangible shift in the room. The air itself seemed to hush as the woman hurriedly unbound Hime's hands and pulled the girl into her arms. Hime collapsed into her. Daughter. The woman had called Hime her daughter. It was the kind of story no one told. When children were separated from their parents, they never found them again. It wasn't a safe thing to hope for. Something Caledonia had never allowed herself to yearn for. Yet it had happened, right in front of their eyes. Every person in the room understood that this was as close to a miracle as they would ever witness. Finally, the queen stepped forward and placed a hand lightly on the woman's shoulder. In response, the woman released her hold on Hime, reluctantly prying herself away. Gaining control of her tears, she lifted her hands and began to sign. She asked what had happened to Hime and where she'd been for so many years. Hime's answers were long, her hands unsteady and mostly blocked from Caledonia's view.
"My queen,"
the woman said when Hime's hands came to a rest.
"This is Hime. My Hime. The water has returned my daughter to us."
"Your daughter was taken several years ago, before she entered her maturity."
The queen studied Hime's face, assessing with that same unbreakable calm.
"Sarah, are you certain?"
"I could not be any more certain, my queen. She says it was as we feared. She was taken by Eric Aher's fleet along with her brother. Her father, my husband, was killed, his body given to the water."
Here, the room paused, and together they lifted their hands to the level of their hearts, palms down as though resting on the surface of the ocean, and slowly pushed them downward with a soft exhale. A fresh wash of tears appeared in Sarah's eyes as she repeated the gesture.
She was taken into service, forced to work among the bullets until this woman and her crew discovered her. She says they saved her when they did not have to.
Hime turned to the queen, her face paler than usual. But with a determined gleam in her eye, Caledonia was only just beginning to realize had always been there. She lifted her hands.
I would not be alive if not for these girls. They fight against Eric Aher's reign and search for their missing family.
To Caledonia's surprise, no one interpreted Hime's words for the queen. The woman listened, clearly understanding every sign. It struck Caledonia that nearly everyone in this room seemed to be comprehending Hime. This was a language they knew. Perhaps a language they all shared. Hime continued,
"Their fight is a good one. Please help them."
Beside Caledonia, Amina was a spear of energy, firmly planted in place but packed with power. Every bit of her attention was focused on the shape of Hime.
"My queen," a man stood out from the crowd, tall and broad across the chest, with a brow that had been plowed years ago and was now stuck in an expression of concern or disapproval. The lower half of his face was covered in a rusty beard that was twisted into ropes and decorated with fine metal beads.
"John," the queen said, giving approval.
"Accepting what the water has brought us is one thing. We will have their ship off the sea before anyone else can spot it," he said. "But giving aid to a crew the father has already marked makes us vulnerable. It is not our way. We accept what is given and release what is taken."
Several others nodded their heads in agreement. They weren't afraid to make their opinions known, which suggested that while the queen was commanding, she also listened. Sarah spoke next.
"It may not be our way, but why shouldn't we release what is needed in this case, when they have returned something so dear?"
"Unintentionally," John continued, looking sour. "They have not brought you your daughter because they meant to, Sarah. It is a welcome coincidence and no reason to make ourselves vulnerable."
"Aren't we always vulnerable?" Sarah asked. "Keeping a marked crew is just as dangerous as aiding them."
"You're right," John crossed his arms across his chest. "We shouldn't do either. We should let them go as they are. Let the drowning lands decide their fate."
The crowd rumbled again. Caledonia was reminded sharply of those terrible moments in Cloudbreak, when Hesperus held her fate in his hands. But whereas he'd been seduced by the promise of the bounty in Eric's favor, these people seemed committed to avoiding both. Like Hesperus, they would make their decisions out of fear, and Caledonia had nothing left to bargain with. An old woman shuffled to the front of the crowd. She was hunched, with tired eyes and silvered hair piled atop her head. Yet her body was strong, and it was clear her mind was sound.
"Queen," she began.
The queen acknowledged this woman with more deference than she had for either John or Sarah, bending her head slightly as she spoke her name.
"Jules."
Jules continued,
"We keep our peace with the father because we have to, not because we want to. Sending this crew into the drowning lands is doing him a favor, one that puts blood on our hands. Perhaps the water has brought us this crew so that we might support those who resist him. Sending them on their way might be better for our community than keeping them."
Here Caledonia saw her opening. She took one small step forward.
"Queen,"
she said, mirroring the grandmother's speech, This crew was built on the back of the water. We are brave, and we are determined. And the sea calls us to fight where others cannot. Please, let us continue. I won't ask for your aid, but I will ask for release, and for our ship.
When the queen spoke, the entire room turned toward her, flowers seeking the sun. Even Caledonia felt the tug of her magnetism.
The water has brought us an opportunity. We have lost many of our children to the bullet fleet over the years. The peace we hold with the Father rests on our labor. Our scavenged metals and ore expand his power and protect our families. But only so long as we stay hidden.
She turned her gaze on Caledonia, and for the first time, it felt as though she spoke directly to her.
This crew is not hiding. They are fighting a war none of us started. And so, instead of keeping them here, we will help them do what we cannot.
It felt like a time to say thank you, and also like a time to stay quiet. Caledonia chose a middle ground and nodded once to the queen. The queen's gaze remained on Caledonia for a full breath before she continued.
We will give you our aid for the good you've done our daughter. We will repair your ship, supply what stores we can for your journey, and feed and house you while you remain in the Drowning Lands.
Caledonia realized with a start that this still wasn't a negotiation, that the queen in no way viewed Caledonia as an equal. Even more startling was the revelation that Caledonia didn't think of herself as an equal. The queen had yet to raise her voice, and this entire room was riveted by her every word. It was a kind of power Caledonia associated with her mother, and the kind of power she wasn't sure she'd ever truly have. Now the queen spoke for her court.
The crew of Caledonia Styx will be our guests until their ship is seaworthy again. All except for the boy.
The boy? Caledonia spun. Her eyes met Orin's.
Bring him forward.
As the queen returned to her throne, one of the guards pushed Orin to the front of the crew. He looked better. His skin wasn't slicked with the sweat of illness and had regained the warm brown tone he had when Pisces first brought him aboard. He winced as the guard tugged on the bindings around his wrists.
A bullet, the queen said, marking the orange scars on his bicep. Your prisoner?
Yes, Caledonia confirmed quickly.
Good. The queen's voice was dispassionate and cool. Kill him.
The guard gripped Orin's neck with a firm, meaty hand and began to drive him from the room. Orin planted his feet, his body hardening for a fight.
No!
Pisces was there in a beat, once again throwing herself between that bullet and death.
Caledonia!
Irritation reared in Caledonia. At Pisces' passionate plea, at the bullet for putting this tentative alliance at risk, and at herself for what she was going to do next.
My queen, Caledonia began, layering deference into her voice. He is a bullet, and for that alone he deserves to die. But he's also the only hope we have of finding our family.
The queen said nothing. She raised a single, graceful hand, and the guard stopped pushing Orin forward. She waited for Caledonia to continue.
Pi, she said, extending a hand.
With a glance for Orin, Pisces crossed the room to Caledonia, braiding their fingers together.
We lost our brothers to the bullet fleet 4 years ago. This boy has seen them. He knows where they sail. It's unfortunate, but we need him. His death would mean nothing to you, but a great deal to us.
The queen didn't deign to return her gaze to Orin. She stared into Caledonia for a long, uncomfortable moment. The room became a drop of silence.
Very well, she said at last. But while he is here, he will stay by your side. If he is discovered anywhere except in your immediate presence, he will die.
Caledonia heard a sigh emerge from Orin. She'd rather have her toenails split and soaked in the salty ocean than spend time with him. But that, unfortunately, wasn't an option. She dipped her head for the queen and said words she only barely meant. Thank you, my queen. Chapter 26 Caledonia tried not to think about the boys sitting in the canoe behind her, or the rope that was now tied around her waist, tethering him to her. The queen's command was even worse than it sounded. Not only was Caledonia to keep Orin by her side at all times, but she was to do it some distance from the village. "They're poison," Sipa said with a dark look for Orin. "You don't bring poison into the heart of your village." Again, irritation swelled in Caledonia's chest. But she couldn't argue. She didn't exactly want his poison on her ship, either. While her crew was released and loaded into canoes headed for the center of the village, Caledonia and Orin were tethered together and pointed away from it. The slagger village was broad, if not dense. Beyond the main hall was a network of stilted houses just like the ones they'd seen before, only these were arranged in clusters. Three or four houses sat around a broad deck and were connected to one another by footbridges of rope and wooden slats. Most appeared to be family homes, but each was oriented around a larger central building. Children of all ages raced across the bouncing bridges, their shouts and laughter unchecked as they chased and ran from place to place. The adults moved more carefully, their steps easy on the precarious bridges and ladders. They kept a steady pace on the water, gliding between the clusters but never beneath them. In a distant way, it reminded her of life aboard the Ghost. "What happens to the people you capture?" Caledonia asked, marveling at the size of the village, "after you've taken everything they hold dear." Sipa didn't acknowledge Caledonia's dig. "Everyone shares equally in what the village produces, as long as you work. Ships like ours can't come by that often. What do you do while you wait?" "We pull ore from the iron bog, then we smelt it down and trade it." Sipa pointed south, where a thin curtain of smoke was just visible above the trees. "It's as honest as it gets." The sun set faster here than it did on the seas, and soon the village filled with the cool blue-white glow of solar lanterns strung from every available perch. It was beautiful, like a field of stars hovering just above the water. It reminded Caledonia so suddenly of Donnelly that the back of her throat squeezed. He would have called them the souls of the ancestors, hanging low to light the way for their loved ones. Or he'd have said they were the hearts of trees, visible only to the people who lived here. Whatever the story, it would have been both unfathomable and magical. It was almost full dark by the time Sipa nudged their canoe beneath a stilted house. This one stood alone, several yards from the nearest housing cluster. "Someone will come by with food. There's a canoe there for you to use." Following the aim of Sipa's gesture, Caledonia made out the shape of the little boat against a post across from where they floated. "Whenever you do come to the village, make sure you tether your beast." Sipa spared another dispassionate glance for Orin, who wisely kept his eyes on his lap. Caledonia didn't bother assuring her that Orin would stay firmly bound at all times. She stood, balancing as the little boat rocked sharply, and pulled herself onto the ladder. The ladder extended upward, leading to a closed hatch in the wraparound deck above them. Caledonia heaved herself up and waited while Orin awkwardly did the same with bound hands. When they were through,
Caledonia let the hatch fall back into place and gestured for Orin to precede her into